91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. For most folks, the sizzle and aroma of a well-marbled steak on a hot grill promises a mouth-watering adventure. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Experts say a heavy meat diet is a health risk for heart attacks and strokes. So why do so many of us continue to eat so much? Though vegetarians, vegans, and others abound, the per capita consumption of meat in the U.S. has only risen. Is the carnivore within us genetic? Did a meaty diet have an evolutionary advantage? We'll learn more when we visit with acclaimed science writer Marta Zaraska. She researches the topic in her new book, Meat Hooked: The History and Science of Our 2.2 Million Year Obsession with Meat. Stay tuned. First, the news. Seven minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday edition. Well, we visit with science journalist and travel writer Marta Zaraska. She's the author of a new book, Meat Hooked: The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat.
It explores what may be an instinctive human craving for meat's protein, even among those who wish to cut back or exclude meat consumption.
Despite medical warnings, in the U.S., the percentage of strict vegetarians has remained about the same over decades.
Marta Zaraska now joins us by phone from Paris. Welcome to you, Marta.
Hi, hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, nice to have you. I was just wondering if your own passion for meat inspired you to write this book.
Definitely my own struggles with meat, I would say.
Okay.
I've been more or less on and off vegetarian for the last 10 years. I still eat fish, so that's not exactly purely vegetarian. But the other thing is that I keep craving meat, especially things like bacon, for example, or pepperoni on a pizza. These things still really tempt me, and this is also why I was so curious to find out, you know, what is so special about meat that I still, you know, cannot let it go, even though, you know, reasonably I convinced already myself that I should, but I still, my taste buds and my cravings just don't want to let go. And I see it all around me, you know, among my friends and family, and that's, many people are struggling to reduce their meat consumption, but it's just very difficult, and that's, you know, where this question started. Why is it so difficult, and why is meat such a food that we were really passionate about, and in the way that we are not passionate about, let's say, cucumbers or lettuce or things like that? You know, meat is different.
Did you want to give it up? Was your reason for giving it up, I'm sure there were many, but were they mostly health-based or moral or ethical reasons?
So it kind of evolved. It all started in a way as a practical joke. Basically, my husband was pulling my leg about, you know, eating animals and poor cows and poor pigs and so on. And one day I just said, okay, there you go. I will not eat it anymore. Even though I wasn't really thinking about it in this kind of way about those ethical issues. And once I stopped eating, then, you know, I started also reading more about meat eating, and then I discovered all those health reasons and environmental reasons and so on. So in this way, I kind of first stopped eating meat, and then I assigned all this, you know, I discovered all those reasons why it's actually a good idea to keep not eating meat.
Marta, the book title includes the words, Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. Is it really, in a way, kind of a lot to ask to think that people can be diverted from having an obsession with meat in just, say, 100 years or so of people wanting to avoid meat?
So, you know, yes, we've been eating meat for 2.5 million years, but many of our ancestors were basically vegetarians for vast majorities of their lives. Because meat used to be a very, very rare food. So it's only nowadays, really, that we have access, and not only to abundant meat for most of, you know, at least for Westerners, but also to abandon other foods. So we are living in a very, very special time, very different than almost all of our history of our species.
Before we get more into the history of it, which I really like to, just to be clear, your effort is, this book is not an attempt to convert meat lovers or meat eaters, and you're not really proselytizing vegetarianism or veganism. You just want to understand why our carnivorous way of life is so prevalent. Is that right?
Exactly. So basically, I'm trying to help myself and others, you know, who are interested in this topic to understand why is meat special. And so I think that, you know, for meat eaters, it can be a great thing to understand why they love meat in the first place. Why you know, they say, oh, I really want a steak. Why, you know, I love, I don't know, hot dogs and so on. And on the other hand, for people who are trying to reduce meat, to see how, you know, it can be made easier. If you know why you love something and why you crave something, and if you want to let it go, it's easier if you know what's behind all those cravings, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't really know what's steering you, it's really hard to give it up. And for vegans and vegetarians, on the other hand, you know, knowing why the vast majority of people don't want to follow their steps, it's also important to know. You know, many people get very kind of emotional about these topics, and understanding why it's so hard for others to also go vegan or vegetarian can make all those discussions much easier.
Could you touch on, Marta, how other primates and meat are concerned? Most primates eat very little meat, if at all, but some do.
Mm-hmm, that's correct. So for example, and that's a great also proof that we don't really need protein to have huge muscles, gorillas, you know, the big muscular apes, they are basically vegan. So they eat things like leaves and small branches and shoots and things like that. On the other hand, chimps, for example, eat meat, not very much of it, but they do eat some meat. These are our closest cousins. And what's also interesting is that chimps use meat in a similar way that humans do. It's not just food for them. It's also a symbol for them. They use it for politics, for example. So because they really crave meat as a source of nutrients, and it's a rare thing to find, once they do, they use it, for example, to form coalitions. So if you're a chimp with a piece of meat, you know, a small hunted monkey, other chimps want it too. So you are in power to decide whom you're going to give something and who is not going to get anything. And this creates you know, tensions and also cravings, and this way you can say, okay, monkey A, you know, will be my on my side, so I'll give him something. I want to convince this monkey B to also be on my side, so I'll also give him something. So they use it in politics, and this is also the way humans used to use meat over, you know, millennia, and this is why meat nowadays symbolizes things like power and wealth as well.
Who were the first carnivores on Earth, and do we know why they turned to meat?
Yes, so it's all, first of all, it depends on what you, on the definition of carnivores, in a strict definition of this word. So animals eating the flesh of other animals.
Right.
First, we have to have some actual animals on the planet.
Right.
We don't really know how the first carnivores looked like. They were probably something very, very tiny. The meat eating they were doing, they were basically drilling holes in some little organisms that look like shot glasses stuck one upon another. And they were drilling tiny holes the size of, you know, the grain of rice, basically, in them. So this was the first carnivorous behavior we really know, but we don't even know how these animals, these creatures, look like. Later on, there were other carnivores that were growing basically bigger and bigger as time progressed. But there were things like, for example, one of the known meat eaters were something called penis worms. And they looked very disturbingly, obviously, as their name suggests. And these were one of the very first carnivorous animals we actually know on this planet. And they were nothing like dinosaurs or anything like that.
Okay. And then... Okay, so let's move along to our ancestors. When did they change from gathering seeds and nuts and whatever to eating meat?
So just like in the title of my book, that was the 2.5 million years ago, as far as we know, and this is when we find the first bones that are marked with the tools that our ancestors were using to scrape the meat off the animal bones. So this is how we know that this was about 2.5 million years ago. And at the very, very beginning, our ancestors were actually scavengers. So they would come across a leftover zebra or leftover giraffe on the savannah, and they would think, hey, you know, this looks like some kind of nutritious piece of food. And they would, if there was something left over, and there often was, they would eat that. Only later on, they started hunting, and the meat-eating only entered our diets really for good about 2 million years ago. And of course, still, it was nothing like we are eating now.
In the book, you talk about the human need for a larger brain, or that the need for protein to develop such large brains, the largest of the animal world, and also our loss of body hair, supposedly, I guess, so we could easier chase animals around for meat. But so it seems that humans needed the meat in order to gain the protein for their body development, from an evolutionary standpoint.
It wasn't even necessarily the protein. It was generally the whole package because, you know, if you lived 2.5 million years ago or 2 million years ago on African savanna, there weren't very many nutritious and calorie-dense foods back then. So other things that were calorie-dense were, for example, tubers or honey, but there were very, very few options. It's not like nowadays, you know, that you go to any supermarket and you have abundant food there. So meat was very special back then because it was calorie-dense, because of fat. It had the protein, but also had several other, you know, minerals and vitamins. So it was what scientists call a high-quality diet. It offered high-quality diet. And this is what our ancestors needed in order to grow their brains, because brains are very energy inefficient organs, maybe just energy guzzling organs, you could say. They require about 25% of all the energy your body is using at rest. So this is huge because, for example, in a dog, it's about 3%. So that's a huge difference, right? So to feed this organ, this growing brain, we needed a very high quality diet, and back then it was meat.
I'm just wondering, though, wouldn't the calories expended in hunting big game, not to mention the risks, exceed the calories that could potentially be gained by getting a big animal? And you know what I mean?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So here's the thing. So of course, meat was great for them, but not necessarily hunting big game. So the meat I'm talking about that was really good for your nutrition was, for example, scavenging or eating small animals such as squirrels or frogs or rabbits, things like, or small birds, things like that. But it is correct that hunting big game is not necessarily the best way to get nutrition. So when going for elephants, it's not necessarily a good idea.
Right.
Actually, there are several studies showing that in modern hunter-gatherers, in several tribes, men use up more calories hunting big game than they actually would. They would be better off basically sleeping in their camps because they're losing calories chasing those big animals. So the reason why they do that, why they hunt these big animals instead of going with small children and picking frogs, is that this is, again, for politics, because getting this big elephant, which is a lot of meat, you know, one elephant is about 900 Big Macs, McDonald's Big Macs equivalent. So once you get it, it is a great piece of food, but and then once you have it, everybody else wants it. You are in power because you have something that everybody craves. So you can really do a lot of politicizing and, you know, like lobbying and whatever with this kind of amount of food that people crave. So this is about showing off. This is not about nutrition.
I see. We're speaking with Marta Zaraska. She's a science journalist, foreign affairs correspondent, and travel writer. And she's written, her latest book is Meat Hook, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. A short break. We'll be right back. What's that, Joe?
Well, it's not rain.
No. Guess again.
Maybe a steak frying in a cast iron skillet?
Close, but no.
Oh. It's not a barbecue grill.
No.
All right, I give up.
How can you give up? It's your favorite food. Listen to that one.
Oh,
going
it's
on.
Bacon cooking then. All right. Okay.
Okay. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Marta Zaroska is a Polish Canadian science journalist, foreign affairs correspondent, and travel writer. Her latest book is Meat Hook, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. And that was what's called, let's see here. It's called the what's it called, Marta? The what we just heard, the sound of bacon frying.
You probably heard the Maillard reaction happening.
Aha. Aha. Explain that. Explain that. Explain those three things for our listeners.
That's right. So this is the reaction that causes all these delicious flavors and smells that arise when you grill a piece of steak, for example. And this is the browning that happens on the surface of the steak or on the surface of bacon. Or on the other hand, also when you, for example, toast bread or bake cookies. So this is basically the browning around. And this is a reaction that creates smells that humans find very, very, very delicious and mouth-watering. And the reason for that is that this reaction signifies to the brains of our ancestors that that the food was cooked, so that it was well done. And a food that was well done was a food that was unlikely to cause you food poisoning, because all the parasites and bacteria and so on were likely killed. That's why we evolved to crave the smells of grilling and frying over fire in particular.
Sometimes those burned little bits are so tasty, so delectable.
Well, and not very good for your health, I'm afraid.
Well, yeah, well, I'll trade in a year or two.
Marta, talk about the other two aspects of meat that lead many people to have these cravings. So that was the Maillard reaction.
Yes, and there is also the fat. So that's also another big thing why we crave meat, and for example, toasted bread is a little bit less craved than that fried bacon. That's the fat in it, and obviously we evolved to crave fat because of the calories in it. That's quite obvious. You need calories to survive. And the third thing is a taste called umami. This is the fifth basic taste, and it stands in Japanese for delicious. And it is really indeed delicious. It makes you feel really like full in your mouth. And this is a taste that's found, for example, in things like cheese and mushrooms and tomatoes, and especially in cheese that has been aged, like Parmesan cheese is full of it. So this is also the reason why we like pizza so much, because they have all these things that are umami. So the mushrooms, the tomatoes, the cheese, and very often the meat. So those three things you need, the Maillard reaction if we fry the meat or grill it, and the fat and umami make it a very, very powerful combination. Because the umami stands for protein, so basically it signals to our brains that that likely the food is full of protein. So that's why we evolved to crave it.
How does umami relate to MSG or monosodium glutamate?
Yes, it's basically the same thing. So MSG.
So all these, the past decades when people have been so much, oh, no MSG, no MSG, it's actually part of our taste patterns, the umami.
Yes, so basically MSG is like, it's like in a way artificial umami extract. If you really want to understand what umami taste is, a good experiment to try is to exactly buy a small, shaker of MSG and make two samples of soup and add the MSG to one of them, and then compare it to see the difference. And the difference that you are tasting is this umami, this fullness, in your mouth.
So, like, if you had two cups of broth, and then you added MSG to one and not the other, there would be a distinct difference in flavors.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Very, very big one. So one would feel just like make you feel more satisfied. And it's very hard to explain to anybody. That's why you know, in our Western vocabulary, the umami taste is not very present. We don't say, oh, this, you know, this soup is not umami enough. You know, we can say it's not salty enough or not sweet enough or whatever, but we don't really understand the taste very well, just the way Asians do. But once you try this experiment, you can really see what it's about, and then you can start detecting it when you think it seems like cheese or meat.
But you say that you write that some people don't respond as much to others that some people are not hardwired to respond as much to umami as others. So does that mean that some people are more hardwired to crave meat than others?
I mean, it's possible. So there are studies showing that about 3.5% of society, of American society, is so-called umami blind. So they do not detect the taste. Basically, no matter how much MSG you add to the soup, they will not be able to spot the difference. And there are no studies showing whether these people are more likely to go vegetarian or not. But, you know, if you cannot detect this delicious taste of meat, then I would assume that it's much more likely that meat would not be so appealing to you, and hence giving it up should be much easier.
Hmm. How do our parents affect our future tastes for food preferences?
Oh, hugely, especially our mothers. For example, you know, there are several studies showing that that we start to learn flavors already in our mother's womb. So when a pregnant woman eats something, those flavors seep into her amniotic fluid, and the fetus, basically the baby, swallows it and tastes it. So there are several studies, for example, showing that if a pregnant woman eats a lot of carrots, her future baby will really like carrots. Or if she eats a lot of garlic, the baby will like garlic. And the same thing happens with breastfeeding. So if the breastfeeding mother eats a lot of carrots, garlic, or whatever, then the baby will eat the same, will like the same flavors. There were no studies done on meat, but this same rule most likely applies to other foods as well, because the flavors just basically are there. And this is what we learn. These are our first experiences, and this is what stays with us for our whole life.
We're going to involve our listeners in this conversation. Have you attempted to give up flesh without success? Or you've been able to give it up, but you still find yourself craving it?
Closet meat eaters?
Or perhaps you're sneaking. Maybe you say you're vegan or vegetarian, or like Marta, a pescatarian, but you still are sneaking a little
on the side.
There's
a lot of combinations there.
And why would you want to give up meat if you have? 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org. We're speaking with Marta Zaraska. She's written Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. A short break, and we'll wait for your calls. We'll be right back.
For business.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're visiting with journalist and travel writer Marta Zaraska. We're talking about her book, Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. We'll give out the phone number again, 1-800-743-9576. Also, email radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. Marta, could you comment on the many varieties of cultural taboos and cultural absolutes of meat? Westerners, they won't eat insects or dog, and Hindus won't eat the cows. Jews and Arabs, a ban against pork. Some cultures even prohibit chicken. Why do we have these differences?
Yes, so as you've mentioned, it's all cultural. So basically, meat is the perfect food to taboo, because this is the food that we that humans really crave. It's very nutritious and also very rare. So this is something that is perfect for making a taboo, because taboos are used to differentiate one culture and one society from another culture and another society. This is one reason why we create those taboos. So, for example, in Africa, there are plenty of different taboos on different meat. As you've mentioned yourself, some tribes, for example, taboo chicken, and some even believe that if they ate chicken, they would become pink and bald like Europeans. And they taboo those foods so that they can say we are this tribe and we don't eat that. And we are different than our neighbors who are really bad people because they eat chicken, right? So this is the same way, like, for example, the British people frown upon the French people who are horrible because they eat horses. So we use the same kind of differentiation between cultures and societies based on what we eat and what we don't eat. And meat is something that most people are passionate about, the way we're not passionate about beans or peas. And that is why we taboo exactly, you know, horse meat or pork meat or chicken meat and so on.
Do you think, or did your research come up with the most prevalent reason for why vegetarianism or veganism fail? Do you think, or did you find it's more cultural, culturally based, that we're just so used to eating meat in our culture, or that it's more genetically based?
It's definitely more cultural. So people really like hearing about the genetical base, and it is there, but it's very, very small compared to the culture and habits and our psychology. So, for example, the first and most important reason why vegetarians fail is that they don't know how to cook vegetarian food. This is something that comes up in surveys over and over again, basically, that they just don't know how to deal with the whole thing. In our Western culture, we have something that scientists call a plate composition. And basically, if you look at our Western plate, usually we have a piece of protein, which is the meat, and two vegetables and some kind of potatoes or rice, something starchy, something like that.
Right.
So we have those four spots basically on our plate, which is very different, for example, from the way many Asians eat. So they have a lot of different small bowls of very different foods all over the table, right? So we don't have this one plate with, you know, big pieces of something on it. And if you remove the meat from our Western plate, you are left with a big empty spot. And many people just don't know what to do with it. And this is also why all these new strategies are so popular, because they can easily help you fill this empty spot on your plate without having to reconstruct your whole idea of how a meal should look like.
And we'll take a few phone calls from our listeners. First up, it's Vicki. She's in Fort Lauderdale. Vicki, hi.
Yeah, hi. How are you? No, I just wanted to comment. I've been a pescatarian for the last several years, and what I find is I'm a working person, and that it's difficult to remain because it's so convenient to grab a rotisserie chicken. But for the most part, meat grosses me out, and so I struggle though because I'm right now working two jobs and. In order to really be a vegetarian, you're preparing a lot of food, whether it's a salad or whether it's something even in the pressure cooker. It's just, you know. But the number one reason I want to be a vegetarian is that, you know, if anybody's ever watched Food, Inc., the cruelty and the mass production of meat and chickens and eggs and all the hormones and what we do to our food is just obnoxious. And I guess don't want to be a part of that, number one. Number two, I don't think meat's so good for us. Well, what's so good about it, you know? But it is hard for me, being a working person, to constantly eat a balanced vegetarian diet without going to rice or pasta or something like that, which I have gained weight because of it. And that's my own fault because I'm not, you know, diligent enough with it.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make those comments.
Okay, thank you, Vicki.
You're welcome.
Marta?
Yeah, that's certainly true. You know, this was what Vicki said. It is exactly what comes up in the research, that the main reason for vegetarians for going back to meat is the difficulty they have with cooking or refining products and so on. But the good news is that things are changing, and there are more and more products available for vegetarians, especially in the U.S. or in the U.K. You know, in France, it's really, really hard. It's much worse than in the U.S. or U.K., especially I don't live in Paris. I live in a very small village. And here, you know, there's nothing, basically. If you go to a store to buy a sandwich, there are just no options. So it makes it very difficult, and these are struggles that are very real for many people. And this is also why, you know, it's great to try, you know, if you have time, of course, to try some cooking classes or try to find some people who have been vegetarian for a long time, because they can help, you know, with this practical issue of the diet, right?
Right. Well, Susan writes, she's been a vegetarian for 40 years, her husband 38 years. They raise their kids that way. None of them seems to crave meat. And her kids, who are 26 and 22, have never eaten meat, even though they let them make their own choices as they got older. But they're both on their own now. And she says, we don't eat meat for ethical reasons. Perhaps that's why we don't crave it. Bloody bodies of animals just don't appeal. Okay, Susan, thank you so much for your email. Marta?
Yeah, so she mentioned something very interesting. So actually, studies confirm that people who go vegetarian for ethical reasons, that it's easier for them to stay on the diet because they develop a physical disgust with meat. This is something that usually does not happen if you go vegetarian for health reasons or for environmental reasons. Even though you may be vegetarian for as many years, you may be vegetarian also for 30 or 40 years, but you are much less likely to develop actual physical disgust with meat the way people who go vegetarian for ethical reasons.
Right, right. Okay.
And next caller, we've got Carl. Carl's in Hallandale.
Hello. Hi, Carl.
Hi there. I'm glad Mr. Cooper mentioned some of the animals we don't eat and people in other countries eat. We're pretty spoiled. A lot of people think that Ben Franklin was a vegetarian. He just didn't eat red meat. But I have yet to meet, well, they say you have some people here. Let me go on. I remember reading an article called The Fat Craving Cave Dweller in Each of Us. And fat has twice the calories of proteins and carbohydrates. So if you can acquire some fat by chance once or twice a year, kill a wild boar, you don't have to worry about starving for tomorrow and walking 20, 30 miles to acquire roots, vegetables, flowers, whatever else people are eating. You have to go a great distance in a Garden of Eden to get those calories. Naturally, we're omnivores. Our teeth are omnivores. Now, I saw this other article recently where a factor also for brain development was the muscles in our jaw. A gorilla can chomp a walnut open. We can't. And part of it is the muscles that they're, you know, their genetic muscles on their between their jaw and their skull, which prevents the brain from growing as large as ours, since we have lighter jaw muscles. Of course, it could have evolved the other way, but since we have lighter jaw muscles and we're eating a higher calorie cooked, once we started cooking meat to get easier digestibility and also more readily available certain nutrients and minerals, and again, not have to walk 30 miles in a Garden of Eden to acquire the proper 23 to 27 amino acids we need weekly.
Okay.
Right.
Most vegetarians I've known eat at least one type of animal product in order to get those amino acids. One friend eats turkey, another one shrimp, Ben Franklin would eat codfish and turkey, white meats only. So a lot of it has to do with a propensity for the horror of killing animals. I think a lot of people become vegetarians. But meat is part of our diet. I mean, it's what humans, in part, are designed to consume.
Well,
anyway,
okay.
I'm not saying excess on that one real quick. In Japan, they'll have 3 or 4 ounces of beef. We'll eat a 12-ounce sirloin, so the cholesterol and fat levels are much greater. They'll have more vegetables, for example, or
right.
rice.
Well, that's similar to the thoughts of course, the acclaimed Michael Pollan, who says, eat food, not too much, mostly plants,
right.
and to use
right.
meat more as a side dish.
Look, if you look at all the old people in their 90s, from my neighbors actually to my father, they never eat more than 4 or 5 ounces of a high-quality protein source at any sitting. Moderation in everything.
Right. Well, that's what Marta actually says. Marta, did you want to respond to Carl?
And we haven't touched on fire, Marta.
Yeah.
The cooking softens and makes nutrients more readily available. All right, I'm going to go back to the radio.
Okay, go ahead. Thanks, okay. Carl.
Right, thank you.
Marta, bye-bye. He touched on some things.
So there are several topics that were touched here upon. So the first one is definitely, it's absolutely correct that back when, hundreds of thousands of years ago or tens of thousands of years ago, meat was a great food for us. But also one thing about humans or even, our ancestors before our species evolved is that they were always very highly adaptive. They were not just omnivores. They really chose the food that were best for them at the particular time of our evolution. So there were times, for example, when we were purely vegan and we subsisted on things like grass and tree bark. There were times when we were eating mostly fruit. And this is the thing also that, nowadays, the times have changed a lot. And the foods that we have available are nothing like the foods that our ancestors had. We had amazing, amazing choice of foods with all the calories, nutrients, and protein that we need. And it doesn't have to be meat at all. And here's the thing about the protein, which is also often, very often misunderstood, is that plant foods that we nowadays have available, when we have plenty of beans, lentils, peanut butter sandwiches and rice and beans, which are complete in protein, we do not need meat anymore to get all our protein because just, the basic diet that gives you enough calories gives you enough protein. Westerners and Americans in particular eat far too much protein. This is a nutrient you should really not be worried about.
And we can get amino acids, all of the amino acids, without eating meat. Isn't that correct?
Of course, absolutely, without any problem. First of all, there exist plants that are as complete in protein, so in the amino acids, they have all the essential amino acids as meat. For example, soy like that, or quinoa, or buckwheat, or even potatoes. You can eat only potato diet and you'll be fine. But also, all the other plant foods, they have some part of the amino acids, and your body complements them, so make them into a complete protein inside your body. So in the same way, for example, like
Martin,
you don't
did you say that we can have an only potato diet and survive?
Yes, it would be unhealthy for many other reasons if you went that way.
Yeah, it wouldn't be healthy, but we could survive.
We wouldn't be healthy, but you will be fine in terms of protein. So you'll be eating a lot of potatoes, but you would not be, lacking on protein, that's for sure. But in the same way, you don't need to eat all the vitamins in one single portion of food. You don't have to have your vitamin A and B and C and D and whatsoever at the same time on your plate. In the same way, you don't have to have all the amino acids in the same sitting on your plate. It's enough that your diet is basically reasonably varied and you will get anything. Because, for example, some of the amino acids are in bread, some other ones are in peanut butter, and if you have a peanut butter sandwich, this is as complete protein as meat.
We're speaking with Marta Zaraska. She's written Meat Hooked, The History and Signs of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat, our last break, and we'll be right back and take more of your calls and emails.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and writer Marta Zaraska. We're talking about her book, Meat Hooked. Marta, let's touch on some of the awkwardness that develops between non-meat eaters and meat eaters. If you're a non-meat eater, might be viewed by some people as rather odd, possibly even less masculine, while meat eaters will be viewed as barbarians and sort of ethically bankrupt. And oh, how can you eat that? How can we somehow make people feel comfortable with what they are? Or should they?
So you touched upon several issues. So first of them was the whole masculinity thing, and that meat is for real men, that the perception we have. And this is something that once again goes back to those 2.5 million years ago when we started eating meat, and the hunters were men, of course, because they were the bigger ones. and they brought this crave, the desired rare food, and they had the goodies to share, right? So to be masculine, to be powerful, was to have meat. So that's why meat got connected to masculinity. And it is still that way. For example, you know, there are experiments that if you can try to experiment yourself even, that if you go to a restaurant, a man goes with a woman to a restaurant, the woman orders a steak, and the man orders a salad, and the waiter, which would, in all likelihood, he'll get the dishes messed up, and he'll bring the steak to the guy and the salad to the woman. Because we still really believe in this kind of thing that meat is for real men, even though, you know, there is nothing in meat really that is necessary for men. Actually, if anybody at all in the West should be worried about protein, it is the fragile, old, and very small, and very light old ladies, because they don't eat a lot of calories in general, so they are the least likely to have enough protein, definitely not big and strong guys who are burning a lot of calories. So that's one thing that you mentioned. And the other one is the conflict between meat eaters and vegetarians and vegans. And this is something that stems from something scientists call a meat paradox. And it is basically a feeling, a cognitive dissonance that we have when you believe in two things, that you love animals and you like eating meat. And these things don't go very well together. And when we feel conflicted about anything, we don't react well when we are reminded of this internal conflict. And this is why many meat eaters feel uncomfortable around vegetarians and try to kind of show them also that they are also imperfect. That's why, for example, a meat eater may point to a vegetarian and say, hey, look at those, you know, leather shoes and so on. So these are the situations. And of course, vegetarians often don't make it easy either by, you know, being very puritanical and attacking the meat eaters. So this is why this creates a lot of conflict.
Tell us about the plight of Pythagoras. That was interesting. I mean, it's always been this way, that there's been this conflict between those who eat meat and those who don't.
Yes, you're right. That's because meat eating is so cultural. Once again, going to the campfires of our ancestors, sharing meat was a very social thing. It was a thing for celebration because it was rare and because it was nutritious. It was the food to share. It was also the food that spoiled very fast. So you had to eat it very fast and share it with others, unlike berries or nuts that you can store for a long time. So that's why humans use meat for sharing and celebration. And so if you say no to meat, in a way it's like saying no to this whole communal, you know, community feeling of sharing something. So this is something that's difficult to do, and this is also something that the other people don't like very much when people are doing. So it's a little bit similar, like, for example, a Chinese person saying no to rice, because rice is such a big part of Chinese culinary culture and the culture in general. So if you stop eating rice, it's a little bit like giving a little piece of your culture away. The same way not eating turkey is a little bit like giving up a little part of your American self. So this is why people don't react well to others giving up meat, because of this cultural feeling.
And back to our callers. Ginny in Redland. Hey there.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I've been a vegan for 5 years, and I had health reasons initially, but to be honest, I was a vegetarian prior to that, and just the horrific butchering of animals is a top reason, but all the other reasons you guys mentioned, I mean, the environment, it's better for you not to eat it, and I agree with the author as well as people who've called in that it's very hard to be a vegan, especially a SOS vegan, you know, with salt, oil, and sugar. You know, I try not to eat too much of that. Vegan, that you can't go anywhere and eat, and you have to prepare your foods. And I literally prepare my foods on the weekend, and I, you know, I have food throughout the week. And there was one last thing. I was going to ask her, how does she know there are fewer vegans, because, or that the number of vegans has not increased, because I can tell you that my whole family, and I come from a large extended family, we all became vegans in the last, you know, 5 years. And just because we think it's healthier and we're not young anymore.
Right. Okay, Jenny. Well, Marta, tell Jenny how you came up with that, the percentage of vegetarians and vegans, and how it hasn't changed much in all these years.
Well, it's basically, it does seem like there is more veganism because there is just more talk about it. But unfortunately, the statistics, at least the Gallup polls and the more official statistics, are very discouraging, and they do show that the numbers have barely budged at all. There are some numbers that are much higher, but these usually come from organizations that promote veganism, so they might be less reliable. But the Gallup polls and other big polls show that the numbers have changed at all.
Can I just make one more comment?
Sure.
My last comment is that I've studied Dr. Esselstyn's book, Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease, and they have recipes in there, so that was very helpful for me. And I read the China study. They didn't have recipes, but also forks over knives, and there's a whole large group of people now that are connected to those people, those scientists, who are putting out recipes everywhere. You can get recipes all the time, vegan recipes, even from Whole Foods.
Right.
And vegetarian recipes all the time. Okay. So it's much easier now to become a vegan.
Oh, much easier.
Yeah.
Okay, Jenny, thanks for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Marta, what did you want to accomplish with your book? What do you hope to accomplish?
First of all, I wanted to start a discussion because I really feel that, you know, there is a lot of talk about how we should be eating less meat, you know, because of health reasons, environmental reasons, ethical reasons, and so on. And yet, I felt that we lack the basis and of why we are eating meat, and we are trying to, you know, change our behavior without knowing what's driving this behavior. It's extremely difficult, you know. It's like trying to stop smoking and make people stop smoking without knowing even that nicotine exists. You know, it's or about habits and things like that. It's really hard to change behavior. You have absolutely no idea why you're doing something. And I felt that there really was no knowledge about that at all. You know, what's really why we are craving meat, why we are eating it. When once we know those things, once we know, you know, what's so specific about the taste of meat, we can start replacing it with other things that have the same ingredients and satisfy our cravings through them. Once we know, you know, that the protein myths are basically myths and how they were created and why they were created and how they are, you know, still living on in the culture, we can start spotting them and not reacting automatically, you know, then just stopping and thinking, hey, this is the protein myth, this is the meat as a symbol of masculinity. And then you stop being victim and just, you know, following it blindly because this is how, you know, we operate. We are creatures of habit. And to break those habits, you really have to know what's behind them.
Right. Well, Marta, best of luck to you. She is a science journalist, foreign affairs correspondent, and travel writer. And her latest work is Meat Hooked, the History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. Marta Zaraska, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting.
Our pleasure.
And our apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our program was produced by Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. Tomorrow's program is a special profile of a South Florida-based artistic tradition, the great choral orchestral chamber ensemble, Seraphic Fire. We'll include Seraphic conductor Patrick Dupre Quigley and superb selections from their repertoire. This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Talk of the Nation next from NPR News.